Okay, I'm all in.
This is the only poker show in St. Louis radio.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
With the only St. Louisan to make it to the final table of the 2008 World Series of Poker main event.
Shuffle up a deal.
This is the Lumiere Place Final Table with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris on 590 The Fan KFNS.
It may be Christmas week, but no vacation for us. Welcome to downtown St. Louis. I am Paul Harris, sitting next to Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips in the Lumiere Place Poker Room here on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. Bradford, we're getting a little bit of echo coming back to us from you. I'll let you work on that and promote that. We've got a couple of great guests coming up. Jack Effel, who is the tournament director for the World Series of Poker, who has just come out with his 2010 schedule. He'll join us to talk about the events that they've got planned, changes that they have in the structure of some of these tournaments, and other changes coming for next summer. A lot of it probably feedback from some of the players, and a lot of it based on the demand that they had this summer.
Oh, absolutely. A lot went on. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of changes. I've read about two or three of them. I'm going to question him about a little bit. And I want to see what's going to be coming down in the future for the WSOP. With the changes in Washington, who knows what's going to happen. But I think it's going to get kind of exciting out there in the next year or two.
I think so, too, and I'm sure they're planning for that. So Jack will join us in just a couple of minutes. Then later on this hour, we'll introduce you to Jim McManus. Jim, to his own surprise, I think, made the final table of the main event 9 years ago in 2000, which was the year that Chris Jesus Ferguson won the whole thing. Jim was there on a very unusual situation. He went there with the advance money he got for a magazine article he was going to write on women in poker. And he decided to use that to buy into a satellite for the main event. And not only did he win the satellite and get into the main event, but then he made it all the way to the final table, came in fifth, won $250,000,
yep,
and then wrote a great book about it called Positively Fifth Street, which was a big bestseller in 2003 and a great read. And now he's got a new book, which is really a history of the game we love. It's called Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. And he will join us a little bit later on in this hour. But as promised, to start things off today, Jack Effel is with us, the tournament director for the World Series of Poker. Jack, welcome to the final table.
Thanks for having me here today.
How's it going, Jack?
Everything is going wonderful. Moving along as usual and ahead of the schedule for 2010.
Good grief, I see a smile already on your face from here.
Jack, before we talk about the various changes that you've made in the tournaments and in the structures and in the buy-ins and all that sort of stuff, I want to ask you about one of the big controversies of the 2009 main event, which was all the people who showed up on day 1D who wanted to play but couldn't because you were sold out. How are you going to solve that problem for 2010?
Well, the one good thing that we will be doing this year is we will have an increased table capacity. We're moving into the glorious pavilion room at the Rio, and we'll also have the Amazon room. So between the two locations, we're projecting about 375 tables, which will give us the ability to take in more players per day. But also, we have to monitor the daily registrations. And even though, at any point, players could show up and sell out a day, we have to try to balance the days the best that we can. Having the July 4th holiday the last couple of years has been a little bit of trouble for people just because they don't want to play on the holiday. So we hope that moving the schedule off of July 4th, starting on July 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th for the first four starting days, will help alleviate some of that. We'll give the players an opportunity to sign up early. Pre-registration is open now, which was one of the other reasons that we wanted to get registration open as soon as possible. And then at some point, we are going to look at, shutting off days if we need to in order to balance the field so we don't get that large rush. And as you've seen in the press release, we're encouraging people to choose their days now because at any point we may shut that day off to try to push players into the other days to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
So if you get to 1,500 or 2,000 people who want to play on day 1C or 1D, you may say to them, you know what, you can't. You got to pick A or B.
Well, here's the one thing you have to look at. Even though we may have the capacity, you have to be able to look at how many players are going to be left at the end of the day that will have to come back and play on day two. And so since there's two day twos and four day ones, you want to make sure that you know you don't take too many players on any given day, so you can be able to combine the field on the second day. So what we're doing this year, just to kind of change things up a little bit, is that we're going to combine days 1A and 1C, and then combine days 1B and 1D. And what that'll do is give a larger field and a smaller field, and a larger field and a smaller field. So when we play down after four levels on days one, that we'll still be able to bring in have enough capacity to not have to go ten-handed on day two and get all the players in comfortably. Based on wherever we net out on in terms of number of total tables, we'll have to come up with a number to say, okay, between days 1A and 1C, we can't exceed this number. And that number will actually come out when we get our final layout plan and everything approved for the two spaces that we do have reserved. So that's going to be the main thing. This is all about logistics. You know, we know what we had last year. We know what we had the previous year. We have a good feeling as to how many players didn't get to play because they came in on 1D. And I think that we have a pretty good pulse on where we need to go for next year. And we were talking about a few hundred players, but we're also talking about spreading out just a little bit more. That way, when that final rush of players come in, that it's just basically filling seats that are open. It won't be nowhere near the situation that we saw in 2009.
Well, yeah, I think you guys got a handle on it now. I mean, there was plenty of blame to go around last year, a lot of it relying back on the players for procrastinating and everything like that on it. Logistics, you mentioned that. You got 20% more tables. You're doing it 1A and 1C, which I think is a great idea. That absolutely will help even it out a little bit. But you still, since you don't know how many players you're going to have there, you could have anywhere from 6,000 to 8,000. How the devil do you handle it with the logistics as dealers, as, you know, food for the dealers? And my gosh, this has got to be a nightmare with that much of a variance in it.
Well, number one, I would say if this was going out to every single poker player that plans to come to the 2010 World Series of Poker, is to sign up and choose the day that you want as soon as possible. As soon as you know that you're going to play the main event and whatever day that's going to be, and I know that there are those situations where, you know, players are trying to round up their buy-in at the last minute, or they're trying to, you know, use their bankroll for other things with the chances of growing it and having that equity in those other events and then applying their proceeds to the main event. All of those things happen. But as soon as the players know that they want to play the main event, they need to get signed up. In terms of the dealers, every year we do a pretty good job of hiring a large enough staff to accommodate any time we sell out, right? And you have to be on the ball all the time, making adjustments based on what's happening in real time in terms of registrations. We have historical data now on what we think a certain event is going to draw. We know that the $1,000 events and the $1,500 no-limit events are all going to sell out. We have to prepare to have a dealer at every single one of those tables with substantial breaks and also a cushion in case, you know, you lose some because they're sick, they call in, whatever the case may be. Natural attrition occurs in every business, including poker. So you just have to be on the ball and have people monitoring it all the time and watching those registration numbers and taking that historical data and using it to our best knowledge to predict the future. And it's just like any other business.
I get a kick. I was out there on day 1D. I'd already played, but there was a lot of people out there milling around. And the response from one guy said, well, you got other Harris properties, or why don't we just start a new one at midnight tonight? We'll have day 1E. You know. And you guys looked at him like, are you nuts?
Yeah, I remember the look on Jack's face and Seth's face and Nolan's face and Jeffrey's face that day when they were dealing with this mess and people were coming up with all of these. So why don't you put us at Caesar's Palace? Why don't you start us at midnight? And all of those things.
Let's think about this for a second. So the day 1D, to give you kind of a reality back of the house, the scene, all of that, We had 2,000 seats available, and we were having a conversation about putting 14 more tables in another area in case we were going to need them, thinking there's no way in the next 12 hours we're going to sell 2,000 seats. And that's exactly what happened. The inevitable happened, which is something that would have been beyond our wildest dreams could have ever happened. Because even taking 2008, where we had a lot of players show up on day 1D, we still weren't sold out. So we still had seating available. So it was really kind of an eye-opener to see that everybody showed up at the last minute, given that they had, 7 weeks prior to that to show up, get signed up at the Rio. They had months prior to that to sign up for pre-registration. So it was beyond us that we would actually think that that would happen. But now that we know that it will, then we'll be a little smarter next year, and we'll make sure that we spread the field out. That's all. Yeah. I mean, trust me, this is an easy fix. We did it in Europe. 2 days prior to the start of the main event there, we shut registration off. We pushed everybody into day 1A for the first open event since we only had 30 tables. We filled that day up. Then we opened up day 1B, and we were able to get everyone in. So we ended up with a nice 600-player field. Had we cut it off or let people choose what day they wanted, we probably would have ended up with 500 players because only 200 would have signed up for day 1A, and then the rest would have tried to sign up for day 1B. So you just have to, do your best to split the field. You want to give the players the opportunity to sign up, but at some point you have to take control of the registrations and say, no, I've got to have more players in this day, and I'm not going to let you sign up. And that's what you have to do, and that's what we're going to do next year.
Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris here at the final table talking with Jack Effel, who's tournament director for the World Series of Poker. All right, main event problem solved. That comes at the end of the 57 events that you'll put on next year. Let's go to the very first one, which is the $50,000 buy-in called the Players' Championship. This is replacing the 50K horse event, right?
That is correct. It's replacing the deemed Players' Championship as ESPN deems on the event every year that it was televised as the Players' Championship, but we have renamed it to be that, the Players' Championship, because that's what it is. It actually determines the best all-around player. So the 50,000 event this year, being the inaugural kind of opening event at the World Series of Poker, we're all excited about it. Our partners at ESPN are excited about the event. And the 8-game variation that you see in the structure, it's basically this is what the game has evolved to. So the first year that we had the horse event, we saw Chip Reese take down the championship, the trophy, the bracelet, where they played the 5 mixed limit games, and then they played no limit hold'em at the final table. So then the following years, we had said, okay, horse is really not supposed to be played with no limit at the final table. So we continued to hold the event in that respect. ESPN continued to film it, and then participation continued to either stay flat or drop down. So then last year, after the 50,000 horse event, with less participation, no television coverage, because the truth of the matter is, if you want to watch a horse on TV, if you want to watch horse in person, it's probably not the most exciting form of poker that you can watch. No limit hold'em is very exciting, and depending on the players, the personalities at the final table, is going to also determine how great or how exciting that final table turns out. But one of the things that we realized was that the event, when it was first held, the inaugural year in 2006, it had no limit hold'em at the final table, and that made it exciting. And it turned out that the best all-around games player of all time, Chip Reese, won the event. So not only was it losing some of its gas in terms of its prestige and all of that, but no limit hold'em wasn't being played anywhere. So we wanted to bring no limit hold'em back. But if we want to bring No Limit Hold'em back, it shouldn't only be played at the final table. It should be played in the normal rotation of the games. So the players are playing No Limit Hold'em throughout the event as well as the final table. So now you'll have a final table where, yes, it is played all No Limit, but also No Limit throughout the rest of the event. Now you also add the Pot Limit Omaha and the Triple Draw Deuce to Seven game in the rotation, and now you can really determine who the best player is, because truly the eight-game mix was the game the Chip Reese made popular at the Bellagio in the biggest game in the world, playing for the highest stakes in the world. So when you look at it like that, this is the event that Chip would have wanted to play. This is the absolute purest form of poker with every discipline that you can pretty much imagine, at least the most popular forms of poker. And so we think that the player that wins this year is definitely going to be the Players' Championship, Players' Champion, and is going to be worthy of the title like they are every year, but it's going to be a little bit tougher because now they have to play three more games that they haven't had to play in the past. So it will definitely determine who that best player is, and we're excited about it.
So, Dennis, here are the games you're going to have to start practicing. Limit Hold'em, Omaha High-Low Split 8 or better, 7-card Rez, 7-card Stud, 7-card Stud High-Low Split 8 or better, and then No Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Omaha, and Deuce the 7 Triple Draw Low Ball. Those will be the eight games, and the final table will be the No Limit Hold'em. I'm sure that ESPN is also happy to get that No Limit Hold'em back at the final table because it's easier for them, isn't it? And better TV, too.
It is easier for them. It is better TV, but let's face it, it is probably the most purest form of poker that there is. It's part skill and it's part art when you talk about No Limit Hold'em. For the best all-around player to have to play all these different games and then be a master at No Limit Hold'em at the end, it's going to be a phenomenal event. I mean, that person is going to have to adjust their games at various times, various games, various players, more so than they've ever had to at this particular buy-in level. It's going to be an exciting event.
Oh, it's going to be extremely tough. You're absolutely right.
And it's going to be the toughest field you've ever seen. You think the 50,000 horse has been tough the last few years? You add another 50 or 60 of the top No Limit Hold'em players in the world. You put those guys in the mix. You put all the best all-around games players in the mix. And you are going to have a tough field, absolutely.
Oh, I don't think people realize how tough this is going to be because everybody has a comfort level. You got eight different games. They feel comfortable maybe with Raz, maybe with a deuce of seven. I don't know, pick it, whatever. And they're going to play more aggressive on some and less, more passive on other ones. Not only do you have to analyze your table and how they play, but how they play each of these blooming games. And you're going to just start to get comfortable with one and, whoops, we're switching to another one. Here we go again. This is going to be tougher than...
Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of pot stealing.
Oh, my God.
Because there ever... players that don't know how to play a certain game, as you said, somebody playing Raz or 7-card stud high-low or, you know, those types of games that require a very specialized skill, I mean, these guys are really going to have to be on their A game.
Oh, you can't have a weakness in there, or you're going to have to get very lucky. That's for sure.
Jack, do you think that having an 8-game mix makes it a better tournament for older players because they have played some of these games, particularly the stud games, much longer than a lot of young online players who may know No Limit Hold'em and they may know PLO, but they don't know a lot of the other stuff that's in a horse mix?
I don't think it's about age. I think it's about experience. You know, I'll take Daniel Negreanu, who knows how to play all the games and who's half the age of a lot of the guys who've been playing stud their entire life and some of those other variations. And, you know, he's a great all-around games player. And I think you're going to see other guys like that as well. Because nowadays, you see more players playing, you know, deuce to seven triple draw. Pot Limit Omaha is probably in the top three most popular forms of poker these days. But the Raz, the stud, and the stud high-low, yeah, there's going to be definitely a few players that will have an advantage over others. But all the rest of the games, I think it's an open game at that point.
Well, I can name a couple of players I don't want at my table to start with. And
Doyle, I can definitely name
go across the other side of the room.
I'm not going to name them here, but I already named one, and yeah. You know he plays tough for all the games.
So, yeah, there's going to be. Got another question. Switch subjects just a little bit. The changes in Washington, the fact that there may be another boost here for poker in the next year or two if everything goes the way we want it to in Washington. How are you going to handle it if the main event suddenly mushrooms to 10,000 or 12,000 people?
Well, again, it kind of goes back to the original question as to are we going to be able to accommodate if a lot of people show up on the last day? And the answer is, depending on where our final layout ends up, where we know we're going to have X tables. So if I know I have, you know, 275 tables, for example, and I have 1A and 1C playing together and 1B and 1D playing together, I know that I'm only going to lose X percentage of the field. So if we play four levels, I'm going to lose about 25% of the field. So if I know I can only accommodate about 3,400 players on day two, I can only take between those 2 days about 4,500 players between 1A and 1C to be able to get those guys back to 2A, if that makes sense. So, you know, it's all contingent upon how many I have. So I have a number that I'm working logistically in my head based on how many players or how many tables I actually have to accommodate any tournament, and I know how many we're going to lose on a certain day. So, for, like, there's an example right there. If I have, you know, 2250 sign up on day 1A, I can only take 2250 on day 1C. So then 2A, I know that at the end of those two playing days, I'll be able to get all of those players back in without having to, you know, make any tables ten-handed, without having to, you know, move anybody to different rooms or anything like that, that everybody is taken care of. And that's what this is all about. You know, you have to be on top of the logistics, especially when you run the largest events in the world.
Well, I know you're going to end up at some time. I really think poker is growing such that you're going to, this is going to mushroom out. Not this year, granted, but have you ever considered raising the buy-in or doing a tiered thing where you have to qualify to be able to get into it or anything like that to limit the numbers down? Or is that anything, you know, two years, three years?
If you want to know if we could handle 10,000 players, the answer would be yes. As long as they don't all show up on the last day and only show up at five times that we're able to put them in. So, you know, we may have, you know, 375 tables, which you would think, well, they should be able to take 14,000 players. Well, that's not necessarily, or 15,000 players. Well, that's not necessarily true, you know, because, you know, here's what could happen. You know, not everybody's going to sign up on this day or this day or this day, but we're going to do our best to level out that field where we can get as many players in as we possibly can. And so if you're coming to World Series of Poker next year, sign up now. And if there's going to be 10,000, and I can just go back in time because I've been here as part of the World Series of Poker since 2005, we know that, you know, the majority of players sign up before the first starting day. So at least I would say half the field. So if I know that I've got 5,000 players signed up before day 1A, then I know that I'm going to have a monster field. But the answer to your question is I won't run out of chips until I get about 10,500 players.
That's okay, that'll work.
Yeah. So in 2012, you'll show up, and they'll say, yes, here's your ticket, and you're sitting in the seafood buffet. That's where your table is. Tell us about some of the other.
At that point, then I might consider, you know, having to move locations. But, you know, at this point, I think anything up to about 10,000 players would be pretty easy to accommodate, given that we can get them in at the right time in terms of registration.
You know, we're talking only about numbers for the main event, but you had a 1K stimulus special last year that opened up the World Series, and it got 6,012 players in it, and that success has led you to add more events at the lower buy-in levels, right?
That is correct.
What are you adding?
Well, what we have this year is you'll see that just about every weekend we offer a two-day start, $1,000 buy-in, no-limit hold'em event, along with the popular $1,500 no-limit events that are in the schedule every year, along with all the other medium to upper buy-in levels for all the other events. So the small buy-in no-limit events, you can choose your day, you can come in and play Saturday or Sunday, then we combine the field and we play down from there. We're expecting a huge turnout for those. The World Series of Poker schedule is all about being able to offer a variety of events at all buy-in levels for all different types of players with all different games. So No Limit Hold'em being the most popular, you're obviously going to see a little more of a variety on that side than you would, let's say, your favorite Raz event or your stud or Omaha 8 or better, so on and so forth. I think there's a nice offering. I think it's a nice balance between buy-ins. And I think if you're a poker player and you play anything at all, that there's something in the schedule for you.
I think you've got it done excellent this time, especially setting up on the weekends. I had a conversation with a couple of you guys this year, and I didn't realize that the large number of people that come out there just for a weekend just to play one or two events, 1,000, a 1,500, whatever that
is. Well, we don't all have 6 weeks to take off like you do, Dennis.
Okay, never mind. But Yeah, the thing is, you go out
We've actually done the statistic on that, and the average person plays about 1.6 events. And we saw about 30,000 unique people at the 2009 World Series of Poker. So, like you said, a lot of the players do come in on the weekend. That's kind of why we've structured a lot of the no-limit events on the weekend so the players can come in and play their favorite events. So you'll see a lot of the 1500s on Fridays and Mondays as well as the $1,000 events in between. That way, if you're a player that wants to come out and play an event, you might get to come out and play two events because beforehand you were not able to do that because of the scheduling, right? That the 1500 may be, you know, a week away or 4 or 5 days away, or you just may play the 1500 and then go home on Monday morning. So we wanted to be able to capture those audiences that wanted to play those events and give them what they want in addition to, you know, all the other mixed variations.
Well, this is getting a little scary because you actually sound like you've got a very logical plan here, and it makes sense. You sure you're a tournament director? Because this is excellent. by the way, that's a compliment.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate it.
No problem. Got another question for you. You had a great team out there with you and Seth and Ty, Nolan, and Jeffrey in it. And Jeffrey now has moved on. Are you looking to replace him, or and you're quite capable of it? Are you going to step into his place, Jack, or do you guys know yet?
Right now, we're going to continue doing what we've always done. We have a great team in place. We're all grounded. We're all plugged into everything World Series of Poker. We're already planning for next year. At this point, there's no plans to replace the commissioner role. Jeffrey added a lot of value to the organization and did a lot of great things during his tenure, a lot of things that I think will continue on for years to come. And I think that we're going to all pick up the slack and run the best World Series of Poker we possibly could. And I think our eyes are open. We know that the players want to have a voice, and we're there for them. You know, the players can come to me and tell me that they see something or they have a suggestion or a problem or anything, and we're all attentive to that. We're all plugged into that. We want the players' experience to be better. We want to continue to improve, and, you know, we want to be the greatest show on the planet when it comes to poker. I mean, and that's what we are. We are the premier poker event, and we're going to continue to make it that way.
One last question and everything like that. Can you explain to me how you've managed to lose all that weight? I need guidance.
You know, that's the toughest one. I don't know if I want to give away that secret. I might tell you how I can structure and get 10,000 players in a tournament, but I may not want to give away that little secret, Dennis. It might be a tough one.
All right.
No, I'll
tell congratulations.
You one word. Okay, I'll give you a little hint. You talked me into it. You twisted my arm. Exercise. That's it. It's all about exercise and maybe eating right. So people will tell you can exercise, you got to eat right. You do have to do both. The exercise is key. Stay active. Stay active.
All right. Well, I really, really appreciate you coming on, Jack. We've come to be somewhat friends out there. You've helped me out a lot of times on it. I appreciate it. You guys sound like you really got your act together for this next year. So I'm kind of excited about it. But I really appreciate you coming on today.
Anytime, anything I can do to help, and feel free to contact us at any time. We're here for you.
Excellent. That, folks, is Jack Effel, the tournament director for the World Series of Poker. Just went over the whole thing, and we're all looking forward to July of next year now.
And by the way, things will start on Memorial Day weekend at the end of May, and July 5th will be the start of the main event, and there's 57 different events and 6 weeks of tournaments to get into. We'll put a link up on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, or you can go to worldseriesofpoker.com to see the full schedule for yourself. And I'm sure Jack would like me to say, register now for the main event so you can pick your day.
There we go.
This is the Lumiere Place Final Table with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris. This portion of the show is brought to you by Poker Stars.
Yes, Poker Stars, that's a site that I play on, and my gosh, have they got stuff coming up now. The Million Dollar Challenge is finishing up this week on the 27th.
This Sunday. On Fox.
We're all looking forward to seeing who Daniel goes against and what the outcome of that is. They've got another one planned for next year, another season of it. You can actually go online and play against the pros that participated in it this year. There's a bounty on their heads. They've got another one where they're trying to establish a new Guinness Book of World Record of the largest tournament ever that's coming on this Sunday. They've got a ton of things coming on this Sunday. The pros are all playing a tournament on there for charity. $1,000 a head for each of the pros, and you get not only to donate to a charity of your choice, but the winner of that tournament gets to become the PokerStars Team Pro Captain for next year.
Wow.
Which is kind of symbolic and everything, but it is kind of an honor, and me being able to say I beat all you guys would be nice.
For more information, you go to PokerStars.net, or, of course, you can click the link we always have on the sponsor page of Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. When we come back, Jim McManus, who's written the book Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker, as we continue live from downtown St. Louis at the Final Table on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
It's a winter wonderland at Lumiere Place this December 1st through the 24th. And while the winds may be howling outside, things are heating up with $125,000 in instant cash and prizes inside. It's as easy as playing the games you love, including exciting new slots and the city's best table games. Earn 100 points each day and win an instant prize. Limit one per player per day. Start playing December 1st at 8 a.m. and play every day through December 24th at 11:59 p.m. Must be 21 to enter casino. Gambling problem? Call 1-888-BETS-OFF.
Tuesday is Poker Day on 590 The Fan KFNS. So here are Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris live from downtown St. Louis at the Lumiere Place Final Table.
Welcome back to the Final Table. This is Dennis Phillips here. I'm with Paul Harris. We're down at the Lumiere Hotel and Casino. You can hear the chips in the background on that. And this section of the program is brought to you by Reactor Watch, the watch that I wear. I want to tell you a little bit about the new Triton that they've introduced. They've got six different styles of it, and it is the choice for any of the serious outdoorsmen, as well as any of the elite military and the tactical police units. This watch is going all around the world right now and is the most durable watch you can possibly buy. You buy this watch, you'll never need to buy another one. They've got new, bold new colors. They've got the same industry-leading illumination on it. I'm telling you, this is the one that I wear. This is the one that Albert wears. It's an awesome, awesome watch. Need to go to my website, thechipleader.com, click on the sponsor link, and check it out. Check out the new Trite. That's Reactor Watches.
By the way, those of you who are wondering what happened to Joe McGowan, the poker coach, we gave him the week off for Christmas because we are so full with guests, having just talked with Jack Effel, the tournament director for the World Series of Poker. And now Jim McManus is joining us. A few years ago, Jim was hired to write a magazine piece on the progress of women in poker and the death of Ted Binion. He used his advance to enter a satellite tournament for the main event of the World Series of Poker. Not only did he win the satellite, but he played well enough to make it to the final table against guys like TJ Cloutier and Chris Jesus Ferguson. Jesus got the gold bracelet that year, but Jim finished fifth and won over $250,000. He turned that adventure into the best-selling book, Positively Fifth Street, Murderers, Cheetahs, and Binion's World Series of Poker. Now he's back with another terrific book called Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. Jim McManus, welcome to the Final Table.
Hi, guys. I'm very happy to be here.
We're happy
Thanks
to have
for
you
having
here.
Me.
It's our pleasure. Why do you call it The Story of Poker and not The History of Poker?
It's sort of like a history, but poker, there's so much information that's not checkable. There's precious few documents that can be examined from the 1840s and 1850s. It's more, has more to do with lore, newspaper accounts, and not the kind of material that that historians usually deal with.
Well, we're right here on the Mississippi River. A little bit
right.
of history with going up and down the river, the old steamboats. I read some excerpts out of your book. I haven't been able to read the whole thing yet. But you mentioned in there something like 1,500 people playing, making their living playing cards on the Mississippi River back in the mid-1800s. Is there any way that's
yeah.
possible? That's unreal.
Well, the steamboats are invented almost exactly at the same time that poker arrives in New Orleans and the United States buys the Louisiana Territory from France. So that those three elements are a big part of why poker became America's national pastime. You know, the country doubles in size. The main means of transportation are the steamboats, and the steamboats are function very much as waterborne casinos, and that's how the game makes its way north, south, west, and East in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s.
What kind of game were they playing on those riverboats? Was it five-card draw?
The earliest version was from French poque, P-O-Q-U-E. That was five cards dealt to four players from a 20-card deck, stripped of all the cards below 10. And that game was played, it eventually merged with the English game of Brag, which was played with 52 cards and had straights and fluxes. And otherwise, the hierarchy of the hands is the same thing as we recognize today. So it's the combination of English Brag, 52 cards, and French Poke, 20 cards, that becomes five-card draw, and the other games that we play in the 21st century.
And how long did it take, Jim, for guys to get really good at that and realize, you know what, I can make a lot of money from people who have no idea what they're doing, not too dissimilar from some card rooms today?
Well, there was a lot of honest poker. You know, most of the games that were played were very small stakes and played fair and square. But the bigger the game on the riverboat, the more likely or almost definite it became that blacklegs, cheaters, mechanics were involved. And they had an enormous number of tricks, devices, mirrored rings, cold decks that they introduced into the action, so that the main poker artistry in those days had more to do with cheating skill than it does with the things that we today associate with poker artistry, reading bluffs, reading patterns, understanding pot odds, and things like that.
Well, we've been involved with poker. I've been growing up with it all my life. I can remember watching Maverick on TV. Mm-hmm. I can remember watching several movies where they showed the card people and then going up and down
Cincinnati
the river.
Cincinnati Kid.
And there you go. Just an awesome number of it. How do you relate poker to real life and developing skills at poker and how that carries over to maybe real life and such? Because it's an integral part of our life, it seems like.
Yeah, well, there's so many different ways. At the simplest level, it's a game unlike golf or basketball or baseball in which you spend 5, 6, 7 hours, an entire evening, elbow to elbow with your friends. So irrespective of poker skill, it's a wonderful social environment for talking, getting to know people much more intimately than you know them over the course of, 18 holes of golf. People make money. They learn how to make decisions. They know how to maximize their profits. They know how to leverage uncertainty. Richard Nixon, for example, won enough to run successfully for Congress in 1946. Presidents have played the game in order to make their way in the world politically. And there's just, the book covers in 52 chapters hundreds of ways in which people have used poker either in a friendly way or in a financially aggressive way in order to change their life.
Well, you've got all the presidents doing it and leaders from the business world. Why has there still been this negative connotation with poker? I mean, it should be out
it's
here.
It's interesting, isn't it? The outlaw
yeah.
cachet continues to linger today. You know, you buy a 2+2 advice book and it's got the Colt 45s on the cover still. Whereas almost all poker is played in legitimate card rooms by middle-class folks sipping mineral water. You know, it's not outlaws. The game is not dominated by outlaws anymore, but still the romance of that continues to attach to it. I think the main reason, though, that people have been, over the decades, shy about admitting they were playing poker is that it used to be a cheater's game, and you took people's money by cunning. You know, it goes against the Puritan work ethic to work hard, save money, take as little risk as possible, and not cheat, quote-unquote, people out of their money by bluffing them or calling their bluff.
Yeah, my grandfather was one of those who did not like people who played cards, and here I am, his son, playing cards on a regular basis and hosting a poker show, his grandson hosting a poker radio show. We're talking with Jim McManus, who's got a great book called Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. When Dennis talks about the real world and the presidents and the businessmen, you talk in the book about how bluffing is not just something we do at a poker table, but also do in our regular life and is even played at the highest possible stakes, like in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, Kennedy, Khrushchev was trying to bluff Kennedy. Kennedy made a counter bluff by, you know, blockading the island and saying if they tried to break the blockade, we were going to have a conventional war that could have easily accelerated into a nuclear war. And as Aaron Brown has pointed out, it was Khrushchev. You know, Kennedy did a pretty good job in that situation, but it was Khrushchev who made the intelligent fold. He understood that there could be easily a nuclear exchange in which tens or hundreds of millions of people died, and he folded his hand. You know, he lost his job as premier, and too few people give Khrushchev credit for saving us from ICBMs raining down on Russia and the United States.
He made a good laydown.
He did make a good laydown.
He didn't have the pot odds at that stage, let me tell you. All right. What do you see that has evolved in the last few years with all the younger players and the internet playing? Is it more the applying math, the probability of the game? Is it more intellectual than it was before? Or what do you see as changes in the last few years?
Oh, God, the changes are so dramatic. Poker's been changing every year, every decade since it came into the country 200 years ago. But in the last few years, with most of the action moving off actual card tables and online, you know, the element of reading body language and faces for tells, that's all but completely disappears online. And the fact that no limit hold'em has become so universally the game of choice. The fact that they chose it for the World Series of Poker main event has made it become by far the most popular game, even though there's many forms of poker that are equally as, you know, the stud games, horse, much more challenging than No Limit Hold'em. The TV element has made No Limit Hold'em pretty much the only game you can play if you want to make a lot of money at it, especially in tournaments.
It's interesting, Jim, because this decade started with you at the final table, as I mentioned, with TJ and Jesus. One of the last years that a pro won the event. The next year, Carlos Mortensen won it. But since then, it's been amateurs. This year was the year that Phil Ivey got to the final table, and everybody thought, oh, a pro is finally going to win it for the first time in a long time. But he didn't. It was Joe Cada and Darvin Moon who got their heads up. I'm curious, having been there at the beginning of the decade at the final table, how you view the final table this year, not specifically the players, but have the players gotten better in this decade since you were there?
Oh, there's no question about it, because there's so many books that, you know, you read Dan Harrington's book, or you read Gus Hansen's account of how he won the Australian Open, and you, without having to risk hundreds of thousands of dollars getting No Limit Hold'em tournament experience, you pick up an awful large amount of information about how to go about your business at those tables. You know, earlier, people had to pretty much gain the main way of figuring out how to play these tournaments was to actually put up the 10K and play them one after another. Today, the ability to win satellites, whether online or in the casino itself, watch how the pros play on television, and read all these books, gives people much, the average person who signs up for a tournament has much greater understanding of how No Limit Hold'em tournaments work today than in 2000. That's
why they also, well, absolutely. And they also, by playing online, you can say play such a huge volume of hands on
right.
It.
These kids arrive, they're 19, 20, 21 years old, and they've played hundreds of thousands or millions of hands. And in the old days, you had to go out on the road and risk life and limb and a lot of money and time in order to play a third that many hands. So these kids catch up in a hurry. And that's why we continue to see younger and younger winners. And that, you know, 90% of the people who play in these tournaments are 20-year-old guys. And
well, it was,
that's not surprising.
It was interesting. First table I was at this year, though, we had to keep reminding one of the guys at the table who didn't play bad at all to put a marker on his cards because he wasn't used to having cards in front of him.
Oh, I see that all the time.
You know, so, exactly. And there is still an art to reading the player. And these guys that come
off
online.
There's no question about that. And that's why the World Series It's pretty unimaginable to me that they're going to, that the World Series of events are ever going to be online, because, you know, it is very tradition, respectful of tradition, and it requires you to play old school poker with cards and bodies and eyes and all of those other elements.
Jim, the book is called Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. Tell us a cowboy poker story.
There was a guy named Poker Jim who, he loved poker so much, he was a ranch hand up in the Dakota Territory, that he, it was in the middle of winter and you didn't want to travel more than 100 or 200 yards outside your camp in those days because of the ferocity of the weather, but he took a job going into a town about 35 or 40 miles away in order to get into a poker game. And he, when they found him, he was frozen solid and his horse was gnawing on the bark, and he was dead. And they put him, his fellow ranch hands put him, it was the ground was too hard in order to be able to dig a grave for him, so that they stuck his frozen body in the rafters of their line shed, which is where they would store their food when they were out on the range, in order to have, like, safe houses as they worked in the open territory. And another group of cowboys went in there to play a game, and they lit a fire to warm themselves, and gradually the heat from the fire as they played the game thawed Jim's body, and he literally... His weight shifted, and he literally came crashing down into the middle of a poker game and broke it up with some finality. And he's now buried at the place called Poker Jim Ridge out in
And I can just imagine somebody sitting at the table go, I want my hand back. I had a good hand. Push him off to the side. I want my hand back.
You can imagine them scattering, you know, six or seven cowboys up against the walls with their backs to the walls, just screaming as though some grizzly bear had come through the roof.
Yeah, I've heard of a bad beat. That's a dead beat.
There you go. Right. I think
very
it was going down.
It happened very soon after Wild Bill Hickok, of course. His bloody head and body broke up a poker game right after Jack Crooked Nose McCall shot him in the back of the head with a Colt 45.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There are lots of great stories like that, not all about cowboys, not all about riverboats, a lot of it modern day. He also talks about Andy Beal, the Texas billionaire who went up against the Corporation of Poker Pros out in Las Vegas. By the way, have they heard from him in a while?
Andy seems to have retired from high-stakes poker. He's now driving Formula One cars. I think he's certainly capable of changing his mind. But since that run of bad luck he had against Phil Ivey at the Wynn, in the Wynn's final in the final matchup of that event at the Wynn, I think he has retired or semi-retired from those heads-up matches. Not that Phil Ivey is not a great player, but Michael Craig, who was reporting on that game from tableside, makes clear that Ivy got all the cards in that match. Beal had basically played them pretty evenly over the course of 6 or 7 years, but in the final match, Ivy, who is probably the toughest player alive at the moment, also caught the cards and kind of broke Andy's spirit there for a while.
And how much did that dent Andy's bank account?
I think
it was about 11 or 12 million, but they had lowered the stakes by that point. It was a gigantic win. You know, he came in, he had some big wins. He went up about 9 or 10, and then Ivy just went on a run against him and took all his money. But, of course, you know, Andy Beal's not an old guy, and he might change his mind, and he certainly can afford to play at any stakes that those guys in Vegas can play for.
Well, we've been lucky enough to be joined here by Jim McManus, author of the book Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. He has good credentials. He obviously knows poker. He's got 28 different caches. In fact, he even cashed out there this summer, I believe, in one of the events at the World Series of Poker.
It's a great read, I got to tell you.
I am definitely looking. I've read excerpts on it, and frankly, I was trying to read some more while I'm driving here, which is really not intelligent.
No, not a good idea at all.
Because I got fascinated by it. So, all right.
Jim, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure, guys. Have great holidays, and I'll see you out there at the Rio in 2010.
Make sure you look me up, please.
Absolutely.
I will.
Jim right. McManus, Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. We'll put a link to it on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, and you'll be able to find it there. This portion of the show is brought to you by the Poker Players Alliance. We got good news this week about yet another congressman joining the bandwagon, only the fourth Republican to come on board and fight for this game that we love. Representative Peter King of New York has become one of our supporters at the Poker Players Alliance. We need your support as well. All you have to do is go to the website, thePPA.org, and join up. Costs $20. That's a couple of bets in a really small game or a tenth of a bet in your average Dennis Phillips game. ThePPA.org is the website. Join the Poker Players Alliance and fight for the game we love so much. That's all the time we have this week for Dennis Phillips and Joe McGowan, the poker coach, who's not here with us today, but we'll be back next week. Have a Merry Christmas, and thanks for listening to the Lumiere Place Final Table on 590 The Fan KFNS.